U.S. military forces conducted a self-defense strike on a facility in eastern Syria used by Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and affiliated groups.
The U.S. just conducted a strike with precision munitions using two F-15s at a weapons facility in Maysalun, that's in Deir ez-Zor province in eastern Syria.
Plus, the U.N. Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs estimated 15,000 people fled Gaza City and northern Gaza on Tuesday.
Everything in southern Gaza, which is where people are fleeing to, is completely overwhelmed.
Today is Thursday, November 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. Wednesday, at President Joe Biden's direction, U.S. military forces conducted a self-defense strike on a facility in eastern Syria used by Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and affiliated groups. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is at the Pentagon. Carla, what have you heard about the strike, and can you fill us in on the details?
That's right. The U.S. just conducted a strike with precision munitions using two F-15s at a weapons facility in Maysalun, that's in Deir ez-Zor province in eastern Syria. It was carried out late at night. They wanted to limit casualties. This is in order to limit what they say a concern for escalation. But it was a clear message to Iran, they said, to target an Iranian facility that had been used by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, that elite Iranian group. And it said that this should be no doubt that the United States it will not hesitate to defend its forces.
Carla, I understand that many of these Iranian-backed militant groups are operating under the umbrella of the Islamic Resistance in Iraq.
Well, they are considered Iranian-backed proxies, but there are the IRGC is actually on the ground in Syria. We reporters, we asked whether or not Iranians were actually on the ground at the time of the attack. The officials that spoke with us tonight were not able to confirm whether or not there were Iranians on the ground. They were unclear at this point if there were casualties. A senior military official told reporters that at a time just before the strike, there were about a couple, this official said, of people in the facility before the strike. The AFP is now reporting that 9 people have been killed in the attack. VOA cannot confirm that, but I can say that officials have told me that there were secondary explosions after the F-15 struck. And that is an indication that there were munitions that exploded and went off because this was a weapons facility. So all of the munitions that were being stored there exploded and caused secondary explosions. We will have to find out in the coming hours and days how many casualties that actually occurred tonight.
The U.S. has bombed facilities used by the militant groups. How many of these attacks since the breakout of hostilities between Israel and Hamas?
There have actually been 41 that VOA has confirmed, 41 attacks on U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria. Most of these attacks did not account for any damage or any injuries. They either didn't make it to the target, or they were the drone or the rockets were struck down prior to hitting the base. But there were at least 4 of these attacks that have caused injuries and damage to several service members. I am being told by officials as many as 46 service members have had either minor injuries or traumatic brain injuries because of these attacks. So that is why senior leaders in Congress have been questioning the response by the Biden administration, saying, you know, is this really enough to deter Iranian-backed proxies and Iran from striking U.S. forces? And the senior defense official that reporter spoke to tonight said that this should be a direct response to Iran, that we hold Iran, not Iranian proxies, but Iran accountable for the attacks on U.S. forces. And we expect Iran to take measures to direct its proxies to stop.
That was VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. The UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs estimated 15,000 people fled Gaza City and northern Gaza Tuesday, which is three times as many people that made the same trip the day before. Shelters are overcrowded and not able to accommodate new arrivals. My colleague Kim Lewis spoke with VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein, who is covering the situation.
The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs estimated 15,000 people fled on Tuesday. That's three times as many people as made the same trip the day before. So how are shelters holding up with this influx of people?
So everything in southern Gaza, which is where people are fleeing to, is completely overwhelmed. You know, we've talked to people who, you know, four or five families in one classroom in a UN school. People really have nowhere to go, because really anyone who could, who had family in the south or had somewhere to go, left. And the people who stayed in northern Gaza until now either were afraid to leave or had somebody with them who was very elderly and were sort of afraid to make the trip. There's a shortage of medicines and food. It's really a chaotic situation where nobody is really running Gaza right now. And the UN is just not able to keep up with that growing humanitarian crisis.
Yes. And is the expectation that more people will be coming in on a daily basis?
Yes, because the fighting in northern Gaza is very heavy. Israel has surrounded Gaza City. Israel says it has destroyed 130 entrances to tunnels where Hamas might be hiding. And so I was actually at the border today between Israel and Gaza. I was at a kibbutz called Kfar Aza, which is a couple of kilometers from the border and is one of the places that Hamas gunmen came in on October 7th and just murdered anyone they could, women, children, and then the Israeli response to that, which is this crisis that we've been talking about. But Israel is committed to the fact, it says, that it will not allow Hamas to exist as a military power. So as the fighting has become more intense, more and more civilians have fled. Israel has been telling civilians to flee now for 2-3 weeks already, but it's become untenable to stay in northern Gaza. And then the question becomes, you know, where are these people supposed to go? Whole neighborhoods of Gaza are destroyed. When the fighting ends, where are they supposed to go to? Israel wants them to go to Egypt. Egypt doesn't want to take them in. So even before the war started, the situation in Gaza was very difficult. Gaza is one of the most densely populated areas in the world. It's very poor. More than 1 million people are Palestinian refugees subsisting on food aid from the UN. Unemployment was close to 50%. And that's all before the war started. So think about what the situation now must be. And it just seems impossible to deal with this growing humanitarian crisis.
That was my colleague, Kim Lewis, talking with VOA correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. With Israeli tanks surrounding Gaza City, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel will assume overall security responsibility after it ends control of the territory by Hamas militants. And Secretary of State Antony Blinken acknowledged that efforts to secure a pause in Israel's bombing of Gaza and to plan for the future of the Palestinians are a work in progress. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
1 month after the brutal attacks by the U.S.-designated terrorist organization Hamas that Israel says killed 1,400 people and injured 5,400, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made headlines during an interview with ABC News.
Those who don't want to continue the way of Hamas, it certainly is not, I think Israel will, for an indefinite period, will have the overall security responsibility, because we've seen what happens when we don't have it. When we don't have that security responsibility, what we have is the eruption of Hamas terror on a scale that we couldn't imagine.
At the White House, National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby was asked about Netanyahu's comments.
We'll let them speak to their intentions, but we are definitely having conversations about what the post-conflict environment ought to look like and what governance in Gaza ought to look like. One thing there's absolutely no daylight on is Hamas can't be part of that equation. Can't go back to October 6th.
At the State Department Tuesday, spokesperson Vedant Patel was also asked about the future of Gaza after the current fighting ends.
Gaza is Palestinian land, and it will remain Palestinian land. And generally speaking, we do not support reoccupation of Gaza, and neither does Israel. Secretary Blinken was fairly clear about that during his travels as well.
The Secretary of State just completed another tour of the Middle East. He met with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and indicated that the Palestinian Authority might be best suited to administer Gaza after the war. One expert who spoke to VOA said he believes a two-state solution for Israelis and Palestinians is still the best hope for a lasting peace in the region. Gilead Scher was chief of staff to former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. He spoke to VOA via Zoom from Israel.
And I believe that this goes through a rehabilitation of Gaza with a gradual integration of the Palestinian Authority with the help of the Saudis, perhaps, the Gulf states, Egypt, Jordan, the United States, the Sunni Western Axis could help that come a reality.
Blinken left the Middle East and headed to Asia for a G7 meeting. But the Israel-Hamas war was still very much a top issue of discussion.
Very much appreciate the words of support and sympathy in the wake of the horrific attack by Hamas that did result, as you know, in American victims as well as American hostages. This is a very important moment as well for G7 to come together in the face of this crisis and to speak as we do with one clear voice.
Protests of U.S. military support for Israel followed Blinken to Japan as international outrage grows over the mounting civilian death toll in Gaza. At least 10,328 people in Gaza have been killed and 25,900 have been wounded, the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry said Tuesday. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Thousands of people were evacuated from the Israeli communities around Gaza after the October 7th strike by Hamas. 1 month later, Israeli authorities are mulling plans for recovery. For many in the affected communities, the pain is too fresh to answer if they would be able to go back. VOA's Natasha Moskovaya reports.
A month after Hamas launched a bloody attack against Israel, Kibbutz Kfar Aza, about 5 kilometers east of Gaza, stands empty, with a smell of death impossible to ignore. At least 52 residents of this kibbutz, whole families in some cases, including babies, were murdered in their homes. Burnt-out, bullet-riddled buildings were marked by the IDF as they secured the area following the attack, while a volunteer group, Zaka, collected the bodies of the victims, leaving somber markings in Hebrew, such as this one, warning of human remains on the couch, where one of the Israeli victims threw himself on a grenade tossed by Hamas to save his girlfriend.
And now we also reach this neighborhood, which is called the Dolzayir, or the young neighborhood. These are mostly young people with stead. And from this neighborhood, I think maybe only one or two people survived. Almost everyone in this block of these 20, 30 houses, which were mostly young people living on their own as couples, have been murdered. Many of them also been abducted.
For the past month, these streets have seen mainly soldiers, reporters, and newsmakers coming to witness the aftermath of the massacre, and Zaka volunteers trying to collect every fragment of bodies for burial. Volunteer Simcha Greineman says nobody was prepared to see the brutality of war inside people's homes.
You come, you see children, adults, people that are sick, laying in bed, they can't run away, and they got stabbed or killed in different ways, brutal ways. People ask me, did you see beheaded children? Oh, did you see beheaded adults? I collected bodies without heads. I collected heads without bodies. I collected children that were stabbed in different brutal ways.
This area is currently a closed military zone. Local residents who were evacuated to safer towns need a special permit to get in. The sound of cannon fire reminds people of the Israeli military operation in Gaza just a few kilometers away. Meanwhile, the families of the 17 hostages held by Hamas from this community are still waiting to hear about their loved ones' fates. Yet there is also a question of what will happen to the area next. Surveys are being conducted among the surviving residents, asking them if they want to go back, under what conditions, and what needs to be done to restore a feeling of security. The scale and brutality of the Hamas attack took the Israel Defense Forces by surprise, and details revealed since have pushed Israel to rethink assumptions about Gaza.
They had a plan, and I've seen maps, I've seen what they were meant to do. They knew exactly where to go to.
Hanan Dan says he knows that if he comes back to Kfar Aza, things won't be the same. Dan says what many kibbutz residents thought about Gaza blew up in their face.
The fact that actually came out and did this and slaughtered us at the expense of their own people. They should have known what's going to happen later. They just didn't care. They don't care. It's like death for them at any cost. And for us, it's clear now that the city of Gaza and Hamas regime is just something which at all cost must be removed. This is not something we can live with.
Dan says his family was lucky on October 7. Their house on the edge of the kibbutz remained intact, and the Israeli army rescued them about 20 hours after the Hamas attack. Yet, like many others from Kfar Aza, he is not ready yet to say if he wants to return. For the world, he says, it may be just another war in the Middle East. For him, these were his friends and neighbors killed.
This place is so full of blood, and I'm not sure about it. It's a question which is still too big for me and still too big for everybody.
The harvest for the season is mostly gone. The lifeline for the cattle farms these days are volunteers that come in to feed and milk the cows. Even residents who are eager to come back to their animals and fields say first they want to be sure there is no more Hamas to threaten them from Gaza. Natasha Mozgovaya, VOA News, Kfar Aza, Israel.
Many members of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Bloc may profit as U.S. companies move production out of China under a practice known as friendshoring. VOA's Jessica Stone explains what that means.
For decades, China has served as the world's factory, as recently as 2020, contributing nearly double the total manufacturing output of the United States. Low wages, a well-developed infrastructure, and government support all contributed to its success. Supply chain consultant Rosemary Coates says these days many CEOs don't see China as a factory, but as a risk, and they're willing to pay more to avoid it.
Now, the executives that I'm working with not only look at dollars and cents, but they're evaluating global risk, geopolitical risk.
Coates says the combination of the pandemic supply chain disruption and Beijing zero COVID shutdowns has prompted some American executives to consider changing the way they look at manufacturing, choosing to work with countries that have a solid allied relationship with the U.S. It's a trend known as friendshoring, and it's a policy taking root among some of the 21 members of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC. Bloomberg data shows that cost-conscious U.S. apparel makers started moving out of China into Vietnam, Bangladesh, and Indonesia even before trade tensions with Beijing began in 2017. In the CHIPS Act of 2022, the Biden administration offered $500 million over 5 years to help modernize and secure new semiconductor supply chains.
We're starting to see the impacts in the data. Across sectors, from auto parts to electronics, the U.S. is importing more from key partners like India and Vietnam, as well as from Mexico, and is less dependent on one single country, in this case, China.
Last month, semiconductor maker Amkor Technology announced a new test and assembly plant in Vietnam. Likewise, Synopsys and Marvell have announced new semiconductor design centers there. Shoemaker Nike has also steadily shifted production from China to Southeast Asia for the past decade. Matt Pottinger, a former deputy national security advisor, says it's the culmination of decades of U.S. investment in the region.
The United States is deeply invested to the tune of well over $1 trillion in that stock of investment that has occurred over decades now.
But trade analyst Stephen Okun says not all of China's neighbors are ready to welcome U.S. companies and their factories.
You may want to diversify out of China. You may want to say, I want to make my supply chain more resilient. But where are you going to go? Because you can't take all of China and put it into Vietnam. You can't put it into Indonesia. You can't put it into India. So you're going to see some certainly diversification to create these resilient supply chains. But there are natural checks on how much that can happen.
After all, say trade analysts, China has spent years building its infrastructure, labor pool, and regulations to become the world's factory. And it's still the best place to make things for the Chinese market. Jessica Stone, VOA News.
Former President Donald Trump's eldest daughter, Ivanka Trump, testified Wednesday that she had no role in her father's personal financial statements, the document central to the New York civil fraud trial that could reshape the former president's family business. Her father and her brothers, Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump, testified earlier. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker has this report.
Ivanka Trump testifies she had no role in her father Donald Trump's personal financial statements, which are central to the civil fraud trial that could reshape the family business. The last of the family to testify, Ivanka Trump, took the witness stand Wednesday, telling the court, "I wasn't involved in his statement of financial condition," about her role as Donald Trump's daughter and an executive vice president at the family business, which she left to go with her father to the White House. She was dropped from the state attorney general's lawsuit alleging Trump inflated his wealth to secure loans. But the state still says she was central to some deals. Ivanka Trump testified she did not recall ever having provided asset valuation information for the statements or having reviewed them before they were finalized. She did recall being shown, in her words, a few documents and correspondence that referenced financial statements, but she said that was not something I was involved in. At court in Manhattan, I'm Julie Walker.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The obligation to respect and protect human rights, particularly in times of conflict, is enshrined in international law. That is why the United Nations established the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine just 1 week after Russia invaded its smaller neighbor on February 24th of last year. The Commission's work has given the international community an accurate picture of the myriad atrocities Ukrainian civilians face every day. At a recent informal meeting of the UN Security Council, which was instigated by Albania, the United Kingdom, and the United States, the commissioners noted that evidence showed that the Russian authorities have committed a wide range of violations, many of which amount to war crimes.
They include willful killings, attacks on civilians, unlawful confinement, torture, rape and sexual violence, as well as forced transfer and deportation of children. Other violations are the use of explosive weapons in populated areas, including indiscriminate and disproportionate attacks, as well as waves of attacks against energy-related infrastructure.
Russia's aggression against Ukraine is not only a violation of Ukraine's sovereignty, it is a direct threat to international peace and security, and it has had dire human rights and humanitarian implications, said United States political minister counselor John Kelly.
The Commission's work to expose atrocities and abuses committed in Russia's war is essential to ensuring accountability for thousands of victims. This Commission's detailed reporting not only informs this Council's understanding of the brutality of President Putin's war, it will also help pave the way toward accountability, justice, and a safer world.
The Commission's report is not a pleasant read. Nonetheless, it is essential for the international community to understand what is taking place, said Ambassador Kelly.
The Commission's detailed accounting of attacks on medical facilities, torture, gender-based violence, and forced deportation paints an appalling picture. It should compel us all to resolutely condemn Russia's behavior.
The United States strongly supports pathways to justice and accountability for atrocities committed in Ukraine and against the Ukrainian people, and we will continue to support Ukraine's capacity to investigate and prosecute atrocities, while also supporting efforts in other national courts and international institutions, said Ambassador Kelly. We cannot allow for impunity, and we must make clear our commitment to upholding international law. We once again call on President Putin to immediately end the war he needlessly started and withdraw Russia's forces from Ukraine.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.